In June 2009, General Motors filed for bankruptcy. Its market share had been falling for years, and it was no longer selling enough cars to pay its bills. It seemed as if this iconic American company was about to disappear, and if it hadn't been for a $50 billion cash infusion from the U.S. government, it probably would have. Ed Whitaker, a career telecommunications man who had retired as the CEO of AT&T, was brought in to run GM and turn its fortunes around, although he'd never worked in the car industry. His book, American Turnaround, written with reporter Leslie Cawley, tells this remarkable story. It's published by Business Plus, an imprint of the Hatchett Book Group, and I'm very pleased it has brought Ed Whitaker to our show today. Hello.
Hello.
Were you surprised to get a call asking you to head GM?
I was very surprised. It was actually would have been the last thing I could have thought of, but I did.
And who called you?
Steve Ratner, who was the car czar in the Treasury Department, called.
You just retired from AT&T at the time?
Yes.
Did you have any plans to take it easy for a while?
I did. I was going to take it easy and spend a little time out in the country and play a little golf, but that got derailed.
And you decided instead to take on this formidable challenge.
Yes.
You'd spent most of your career at AT&T, which provides a service, while General Motors builds and sells a product. Aren't they fundamentally two very different kinds of industries?
Not really. It's the same people doing the same thing. You're either selling telephone service or you're selling vehicles.
So it's really a matter of whether you have good management or bad management?
Yeah, I think so.
What did you think you'd have to find out about cars? Because most of the people who have run the car makers have come up from either the sales area or from the engineering area, not from the Bluetooth telephone area.
Well, that's true. And I told Steve Ratner when he called I could drive, I could start a car. That was about it. That's all I knew. I'd been at AT&T 44 years, but I had worked in big companies, and I thought, well, maybe management has some similarities, so I'd give it a try.
Although, in my experience, when somebody comes into a company from the outside, all of the entrenched people say, well, this guy doesn't know anything, and they don't respect you very much. It takes a lot of work to get them to go along with what you want.
And I think it was the same thing at GM. Who is this guy? He didn't know anything. Why is he here? But I think over a relatively short period of time, we got to like one another, and I think it worked out just fine.
Do you think part of your success is the circumstances of where you come from, how you grew up, the fact that you didn't even think you'd go to college after you graduated from high school?
I think there's some of that, sure.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Ennis, Texas, which is a small town 40 miles south of Dallas. It's bigger now, but it was small then.
What'd your father do?
My father was a railroad engineer, Southern Pacific Railroad, for 50 years. And I thought that's what I'd do, is go to work for the railroad. But I didn't. My mother had different ideas. She thought I should go to college. That was strange to me, but I did it anyway at her urging and others, and I went to Texas Tech in Lubbock, Texas.
And studied engineering?
Studied engineering.
How did you get an internship with Southwest Bell during your junior year?
Southwestern Bell hired people for summer employment, and I essentially went and begged. I begged for a summer job, and a man named Mr. Frank Witten took pity on me, and I got one.
Well, most of us tend to think of engineers as geeky people with pocket protectors who are usually pretty socially inept. But one of your strengths clearly is dealing with people. Did you have to discover that, or was it something that was apparent from the start?
No, I think I discovered that. I was a pretty shy guy for a long time and still am to some extent. But I think you get better at that over time as time goes on. I come from the slide rule days. There were no calculators. This was slide rules, you know.
I know, but the person pulls out the slide rule, he says, uh-oh.
That's right.
Did you come out of a family of union members?
I did.
How do you think that affected your perspective? Because so much of what we see as what goes on in American industry today is a war between management and unions, to the point now where there are hardly any unions.
Well, I grew up in a union family. I remember strikes. I was comfortable around that. And I must say, I've had a good experience with unions my whole working career.
Did you feel like a traitor when you moved into management?
No, not really. I mean, I think we're all after the same thing, the union and management. I think you want to be a success. You want the company to succeed. You want to be able to do the things you want to do as an individual. I never saw that as different between union members and management.
How long did it take you to work up your way up the ladder to be appointed CEO of Southwestern? It was a baby bell, right?
It was the smallest of the baby bells. I was there 44 years and chairman 17, so whatever that subtraction is how long it took.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, I don't know how that happened. If you asked me how I became CEO, I couldn't tell you.
And you were a surprise pick.
Yeah, it was kind of a surprise pick.
The heir apparent came to you before the board made its announcement to ask you to stay on after he became CEO. Did you know at the time that you would wind up in the job?
I did not know. It was a surprise.
What did you tell him?
Well, I can't remember what I told him. I guess I was so shocked, but I probably said, sure, I'll stay on.
And then everybody was kind of surprised that you were asked to be CEO.
Yeah, I think so.
At the time you were appointed, Southwestern Bell's headquarters were in St. Louis. What did you find when you arrived there?
Well, I was working in St. Louis at the time in another job at Southwestern Bell, so I was familiar with St. Louis. Company had been there for many years. The company was Missouri, Kansas, Oklahoma, Arkansas, and Texas. And Missouri had been the headquarters for a long time, but I'd lived there for several years.
And then you decided to strip down management? That must have made you popular.
Well, I don't know that I stripped down management so much. In fact, we did very little of that. We did very few, if any, layoffs over my time. But we did move the company from St. Louis to San Antonio.
And who was the governor of Missouri at the time?
John Ashcroft.
How did he react?
Not well. Not well at all.
Actually, his reaction was so bad that you felt you had made the right decision to get out. At that time, Ann Richards was the governor of Texas.
Texas, right.
A lot more welcoming, I suspect.
She was very happy to have us in Texas. And, you know, John was a friend, a good friend, but facts were our market was 60% in Texas and 16 or 18% in Missouri, and we were a service company. We needed to move to our markets.
Did you also see it as a way to change the culture of the company?
I did.
What did you see as the most obvious problems with the culture of Southwestern when you took over?
It was clear to me that we had to get moving. We couldn't stay as a baby bell or we wouldn't last very long. We were relatively small. We had to go grow. We had to grow fast and big. It's a scale sort of business. And so we had to do things differently.
Now, you grew up in a small town, as we said.
Yes.
Were any members of your family members of the country clubs?
No.
Do you think were they excluded or were you just too poor? Was this a class thing?
I think we probably couldn't afford it.
Uh-huh. Do you think that affected your perspective? Because most CEOs, I think, come out of comfortable backgrounds. They get their MBAs at Harvard or Yale, and
they
kind of knew all the other guys.
I don't know that it did. I didn't know anybody. We didn't have very much money as a family. It probably affected me.
You didn't have a Harvard MBA.
No. I was so glad to get out of school that I knew I didn't want to go back.
Do you think that your credentials hurt your credibility with some people?
Probably.
How did you learn to manage? I mean, that isn't something that's taught at an engineering school.
No, it isn't. I don't know the answer to that. I've just always tried to be myself. And I guess if I have any skills, maybe I've been successful at management, but it's not something that you get out of a book or something that I read.
But it's something you must have thought about.
Well, sure, I thought about it a lot.
What do you think are the fundamental strengths of a good manager?
Treat people like you like to be treated. I think that's number one, certainly. is have some objectives or aims in mind and try to accomplish those, and don't dilly-dally around. Go when you think of it, you think it's good, go do it. But I think treat people like you like to be treated is probably the best.
Well, it's been my experience that people who have problems managing say, I want to be friends with all the people who work with me. And then one day they say, do as I tell you to do because I'm the boss. And the people who thought that they were friends suddenly realize, well, we're not really friends. Yeah. You got to be consistent, don't you?
You got to be consistent. That's right.
So when did you develop your management principles? Was that before you became CEO?
Well, maybe I had a few then, but, you know, I'd worked for 30-something, I guess 30 years, more than 30 years in a number of management jobs. I guess you learn those things over time. You develop them. You see what might work, what might not. But it's an evolution, not revolution.
And you take issue with CEOs who manage strictly by the numbers.
Yeah.
What kind of numbers are you talking about?
Well, I think if you shoot to make a certain number like earnings per share or whatever number you choose, I don't think that's the right way to do it, you know. Might be circumstances, but I'm not aware of any of them.
Judging from your tenure at AT&T, you did believe in acquisition as a management style.
I did.
What do you think is the biggest mistake that managers make? Well, first of all, acquisitions can backfire, can't they?
They can. They can. You do take some risk when you make acquisitions.
As Bank of America is still discovering.
A lot of mistakes made in acquisitions. But as I said, the telephone business, we had to get bigger. We had to do that quickly. It's a scale, scope kind of business. You could see wireless coming along. We were small, so acquisitions were one way to grow. We also grew, as they say, organically, but we had to do both.
My guest is Ed Whitaker, former CEO of AT&T and General Motors, who's written with the help of Leslie Cawley, American Turnaround, Reinventing AT&T and GM and the Way We Do Business in the United States. It's published by Business Plus. We'll continue our conversation after this. We're back with Ed Whitaker, who is the former CEO of AT&T and General Motors. He's written with the help of Leslie Cawley a book called American Turnaround, Reinventing AT&T and GM and the Way We Do Business in the United States of America. It is published by Business Plus, which is a division of Hachette. How did you manage to buy AT&T Wireless when you were the lower bidder?
In the final, it was Vodafone and us. And Vodafone made the offer. We got the word that Vodafone was flying back to Europe to get their board of directors approval. And Dwayne Ackerman, who is the chairman of Bell South and 50% singular owner, and I decided this was beachfront property. There was only one. We'd wake up our board of directors, get approval to outbid them. In the middle of the night, we did, and they accepted our offer. And so we got AT&T Wireless.
Now, you tended to break down the barriers between workers and management. You got rid of special elevators and lunchrooms and such. And obviously, that works. It creates a better work environment. Why do you think more companies don't do that?
Well, I don't know how many do it, but I just never felt right with one group of the people at the company being treated differently than others, and that was not the way I was brought up. It just didn't set right with me. I could see no purpose for it. It was ridiculous.
Well, do you think that in general most managers see the workers as adversaries?
I don't think so, but
well, they're trying to keep overtime down while workers are trying to maximize it. There's a little war going on there.
They're trying to keep costs down, but I think most workers certainly want to do what's right for the company and recognize that if the company's doing well, they're going to do well.
Why did Southwest and Bell have so many name changes while you were in charge?
Well, because, first of all, we were Southwestern Bell, and then we made some acquisitions. Well, Southwestern wasn't applicable anymore. We bought California, Pacific Telesis, and Nevada. And so Southwestern Bell just didn't seem to, you know, define the company anymore.
You say that your deal with Apple on the iPhone was an example of betting on people, not products. You didn't think that the iPhone was an exciting new product?
Well, the iPhone was interesting. A guy named Stan Sigmund was running our wireless business. Stan's just a super manager and knew wireless in and out. He had had several meetings with Steve Jobs. Steve wouldn't show us the iPhone. He had only one copy. He kept it in his coat pocket. We had to come to New York to see what it looked like. It was a very secretive sort of deal. But he described, we got to see what it looked like. We got to see what potential applications were there. We got to talking about it. And finally, we said, let's give this a shot. This has some potential. It was very expensive. We had to push a lot of chips out on the table. It was a big bet.
But then you did get, for a while, you got exclusivity.
We did get exclusivity.
And that gave you a major jump on all of the competition.
If it worked. That's what was unknown, was this thing really going to work? Was it going to take off? In 1990, Bell Labs told me that we'd probably have 1 million subscribers in the wireless business. Well, there's hundreds of millions now. They missed that one a little bit.
And you decided Apple rather than Nokia or BlackBerry or some of the others?
Apple,
Samsung?
Apple had the iPhone. That was the first application of a smartphone. It was the first smartphone we'd seen.
So things are booming. Why did you leave AT&T?
Because I'm old. I'm older. I left AT&T when I was almost 66. You know, I think you internally sort of know when it's time. I'd been chairman 17 years. That's a long time. We'd gone through a lot. It was just time.
And then you said you thought you'd play some golf. You wound up taking the job at GM.
Right.
Did you think it was your first order of business to clean house there?
No, I really didn't. I went up with an open mind and see what's wrong with GM.
Well, a lot of people claim that it was the kinds of contracts that the big automakers had made with the unions going all the way back to the 40s, some of them to actually preempt any government involvement like with health insurance and things like that, but now costing a lot of money.
Well, that wasn't the problem at all, and I believe that when there's a problem, you can always trace it back to management, and I think that's what happened over a period of time at GM.
You caused a big stir at GM when you went by yourself to see the head of the UAW.
Well, I had not met Ron Gettelfinger. He was the head of the UAW.
What, did they expect you to come with a posse?
I don't think they expected me to come. I just one afternoon got in the car and drove down to the Solidarity House, which is where they were headquartered, got out of the car, walked in, told the receptionist who I was and who I wanted to see. She arranged that, and Ron and I got acquainted.
So you came in at the time as part of the government bailout?
Well, I came in after the government bailout. As GM emerged from bankruptcy, I showed up.
And how did people working at GM feel about the bailout?
People didn't feel very good at all. The morale was quite low. They had failed. They didn't know what the future held. They didn't know their own security. They didn't know those sorts of things. It was pretty befuddled.
Well, people now credit the bailout with a lot of votes for Barack Obama in this last election. So the attitude changed? People felt that it had saved GM?
Well, I think the bailout was the only plausible solution, and I've always agreed with it. There was no private sector money available or appetite to do it. GM's such a part of this country and has been for years, going back to World War II. You couldn't let GM go away. And not only that, but there were thousands of suppliers. It would have affected millions of jobs, not only GM, but many, many more outside of the GM company.
Now, many people have called GM government motors, and people misquote Charlie Wilson. He never really said what's good for General Motors is good for America, but most Americans associate the company in that statement.
Right.
And you were joining that company that once was the most successful company in America.
Well, I just didn't think we could let General Motors vanish. I mean, it's such a great part of this country.
You say that GM employed a kind of matrix approach to management.
That would mean that means to me you have multiple bosses and therefore nobody is in charge.
So was it necessary to clear out the old guard?
Yes.
Was it difficult to hire from the outside because of TARP rules about compensation?
Yeah, we didn't hire any from the outside that are, well, just a couple, but very few.
Now, you were brought in as the chairman.
Mm-hmm.
How did you come to be named CEO as well?
Well, the board decided in December that when we first started, we would give the current management a select amount of time to make certain changes. Those changes didn't occur, and in December of that year, we decided to make the change, and I became CEO also.
And what were your goals for the company? Why did you think it was necessary to do the big IPO?
Well, the IPO was the first step to not be GM. It was to pay back the government, which is really paying you and I back what we had loaned. But I thought it was important that we become profitable as quick as possible and start building really good vehicles.
Well, you inherited what was already in the pipeline, including the Volt, which has been a controversial car.
Yeah, sure.
Car.
The cars were in the pipeline.
Well, some people have decried the amount of money the government has put into the Volt, considering the fact that it hasn't sold all that well.
Well,
gets mixed reviews.
Some. I think companies have a responsibility to try new technologies to see if you can't invent or do something new, given what's happening in climate and environmental. I think we did that at GM. The Volt's a great vehicle.
You think it's better than the Ford hybrid?
I do.
You
wouldn't expect me to think anything different.
You were the head of the Boy Scouts of America at one point?
Yes.
What do you think about the recent decision on gay members?
Well, you know, I do think the Boy Scouts are the best youth organization in America. I've been associated with it a long time. Things change.
Ed Whitaker has written, with the help of Leslie Cawley, American Turnaround, Reinventing AT&T and GM and the Way We Do Business in the USA. It's published by Business Plus. Thank you so much for being with us. By the way, Ed Whitaker will be speaking with Andy Sewer of Fortune Magazine at the Cornell Club tomorrow at noon. That's at 6 East 44th Street. To register, go to our show page at WNYC.org.